hopes the UK can push the bilateral ties on the right track on the basis of mutual respect and win-win cooperation. Sunak had challenged Truss this summer in race of prime minister, but lost to her in a vote of the party's rank-and-file members. Chinese experts said this latest series of political drama surrounding the UK premiership has exposed the rigidity and decay of UK's political system, which can hardly produce capable politicians to make optimal decisions for the country. The Conservative Party, which is now in power, chooses someone who is eligible for the Downing Street, and before this person presents a decent plan of governance, he or she is stabbed in the back by opponents in the party and steps down. Zhao Junji, a research fellow at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences Institute of European Studies, told the Global Times, describing this pattern has made the UK politics more dramatic than late-night TV drama. He warned that one of the toughest tasks Sunak faces is how to survive until next election, originally scheduled for January 2025. Right after Sunak won the Conservative Party leadership race, there were calls for a general election by voices from other political parties. Labour lawmaker Angela Rayner complained that Sunak's accession was a coronation and that the Tories could not keep doling out prime ministers every month. After Truss stepped down, one petition calling for a general election had attracted more than 879,000 signatures. In the UK, general elections must be held at least every 5 years. However, the prospect of Britain seeing its third prime minister since the last poll in 2019 and the second to come into power without a public vote will put pressure on Truss's successor to ask the public for a new mandate, CNN reported. The possibility of earlier elections is very high if Sunak fails to tackle the sky-high inflation in the UK in half a year of his governance, or meets strong pushback of his policies, or encounter major obstacles of forming a cabinet. Li Guangji, a research fellow from the Shanghai Academy of Global Governance and Area Studies under the Shanghai International Studies, told the Global Times. Although observers granted Sunak, who possesses technocratic style of governing, they don't believe he is the savior of a crisis-wrecked UK. Except for different dissent, Sunak is no different from his Conservative Party predecessors. The election is in essence an election within the Conservative Party, thus the desirable candidates are just chosen by Conservative Party members who are mostly rich, said Zhao. Zhao noted that Sunak's Indian heritage and his wealth may put him under more strict scrutiny as prime minister, and in return will weigh on his decision-making process. Being a leader from a minority group, he may tend to be more conservative just to avoid wide criticism, and he will be very vulnerable if people see his policy as favoring the rich and big companies, said Zhao. The New York Times also reported that critics speculated that Sunak's Indian heritage might have hurt him in the race with some party members this summer. His wealth was viewed as the bigger issue. Also, Middle East Eye wrote, this takes writers to the big question mark surrounding the Sunak premiership. How will he handle the looming recession in Britain? Ever since John Maynard Keynes reinvented the laws of economics in 1930s, governments have increased spending to combat recessions. With a financial black hole to be filled, Sunak's masters in the financial markets will not allow him to boost output through fiscal methods. They will insist on cuts, forcing Britain into austerity. Unemployment will rise. Living standards will fall faster than at any time in the post-war period. Public services will be slashed, meaning poverty and even destitution. Britain has not faced a period like this since the oil crisis in 1970s, and possibly experts fear even the Great Depression of 1930s. So-called Truss Economics was an attempt to evade this predicament. Sunak will have to face it. As Chancellor, Sunak has proved that he has the financial skills to manage the national budget. Has this unelected Prime Minister got the political skills to explain spending cuts and job losses to the British people? On the evidence so far, the answer is no. Sunak started out as favorite to win last summer's Tory leadership campaign. He threw it away because he lacked charm, empathy, and authority. It was quite something to lose to a candidate as useless as Truss, but Sunak managed it. To his great credit, he did warn of the disastrous consequences of Truss's economic plans and had the good sense to steer clear of her short-lived government. But in other respects, he kowtowed to Tory members in his desperation to get the top job. Like her, he launched attacks on activist lawyers and stuck with the shaming and hopeless policy of shipping refugees to Rwanda. When Truss disastrously proposed in a letter to conservative friends of the Zionist regime to ponder a shift of the British embassy in the occupied territories to Al-Quds, hapless Sunak lacked the wit to steer clear of a daft policy certain to damage British interest. Not to be outdone, Sunak actually moved in lockstep with Truss, saying that he too would consider ripping up British foreign policy in the West Asia region in order to follow former US President Donald Trump's decision to shift the embassy. There is already evidence that, like Truss and Johnson before him, Sunak will end up being captured by the Tory right. According to a disturbing report in The Times, Sunak has assured Eurosceptics in private that he will maintain the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill, stick with the Rwanda policy, introduce new legislation to prevent the European Convention on Human Rights blocking deportations, and to take a firm line on other ideologies in schools. If this report is accurate, Sunak will seek to win the necessary political capital to pursue brutal austerity policies by pandering to the far right and waging culture wars against the most vulnerable people in the world. To put it another way, he will try and make up for his lack of democratic legitimacy by resorting to ugly populism. If so, he will deserve to fail. Let's hope Britain's first Prime Minister of Asian heritage is better than that and possesses the courage to lead Britain out of the cesspit he inherits from Boris Johnson and Liz Truss. If so, there is a chance, with a lot of luck, that Sunak could become a good Prime Minister at this turmoil in Britain. We'll be right back. Midstream.
It was unprecedented and perhaps unexpected that Uday Tamimi, after targeting an Israeli female soldier, goes in hiding for 10 days and then reappears to carry out another shooting operation and be martyred as a result. This is what the Israeli occupation security and military system have never experienced before. Well, they should get used to it. It seems that the current wave of escalation in the West Bank will bring many more surprises, which the Israeli entity has so far been unable to anticipate, avoid, or thwart, let alone prevent its sequence of events. For 10 days, the Israeli security and intelligence system lived in paranoia, driven by hysteria generated by its failure to find the young fighter Uday Tamimi, who stormed the Shafat checkpoint on October 8th. Attacked enemy soldiers and killed a female soldier before he withdrew in peace. While the occupying power was employing all its security, intelligence, and technological capabilities to find Tamimi and erase the traces of the slap he had directed at its army, the latter was living in disguise in the city of Al-Quds and planning his next attack with his personal pistol. The next target in mind was the settlement of Ma'ali Adumim, the pearl of the Zionist project in the holy city of Al-Quds, ripping apart the prestige of Israeli deterrence and security and squashing a system that once again seemed weaker than a spider's web. Tamimi drew in less than 2 weeks new features of the Zionist-Palestinian clash, which may mark the beginning of a new phase of resistance in the West Bank, the first of which is that the resistance guerrilla has become the one who pursues the occupation forces and pursues its illegal colonial settlers and ambushes them. Meanwhile, the same cannot be said about the Zionist entity, as Uday was able to deal a double blow to the enemy. The first is by storming a sensitive security fortress equipped with all technological and military means and withdrawing from it without scratches. The second is remaining in hiding for a long period of time and carrying out another operation in an unexpected location for the Israeli authorities who are searching for him in the Shafat camp, which shows the advanced capability of camouflage and disguise. Tamimi dispelled all the Zionist measures and succeeded in initiating a new attack, during which he fought a fierce, heroic, and unforgettable battle with the occupation forces. A battle that will leave political and security repercussions on the enemy, the first of which was the Palestinians who took to the streets in cities, villages, and camps without a decision or warning after the announcement of Tamimi's martyrdom. Since then, the entire West Bank is reliving nights of confrontation beginning in the Shafat camp in particular, reaching the city of Al-Quds, and then spreading even further. Welcome to the Middle East Stream, I'm Marwa Osman. Uday Tamimi ended 11 days of Israeli stalking in his own style. Abu Sabah, which means the brave one, as the people of Shafat camp nicknamed him when they saw him in the first video operation arriving on Wednesday night at the Ma'ali Adumim checkpoint on his feet. Uday pointed out his single pistol he fired at three occupation soldiers who were guarding the checkpoint, who then emptied their bullets at him. He jumped into the sky, trying to avoid it, then fell to the ground. He leaned on his hands and continued shooting. Bullets penetrated his body. He switched the ammo amid clash and kept shooting. Zionists drowned him with bullets. The body that had exhausted an entire army, which had been searching for him throughout 264 hours of pursuit, finally calmed down and transcended to eternal peace. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Daniel Yagic, academic and political commentator. Thanks a million for being with us, Dr. Yagic. Now, such an important scene that we all witnessed last week, but in his will, martyr Uday Tamimi, he wrote down on a torn piece of paper, my operation in Shafat was a drop in the roaring sea of struggle. Although such an effort will not liberate Palestine, the fruit of the process, according to his description, will mobilize hundreds of young people who will carry my gun and my body. This will touch the heart of every free soul in the world. But do you think, did it mean anything for Zionist Israel?
Yeah, so the marchers' act of resistance was obviously a reaction to the structural terrorism, Israeli terrorism that Palestinians have been exposed to for decades, and in particular, of course, in the last days and weeks, the heightened oppression and on top of the structural oppression in the West Bank. I think what we've seen in the last days happening in Palestine is that his words have inspired many to take to the streets and to continue their resistance against this colonial and genocidal regime. Now, the question what this actually means for the Zionist regime, I think we can see that, again, the Zionist regime is scared. It's another moment of fear for the settler regime because it displays the continuity of the Palestinian resistance, to which the Zionists generally react with even more measures that are harsh in terms of fragmenting the population, establishing checkpoints, controlling their movements. But none of this, of these actions of this nuclear-armed first world superpower to that extent have actually managed to silence Palestinian resistance. And this latest case showed once again how these words have inspired more people to take to the streets. So I think it's another moment of fear for the settler, especially if we again go back to the situation of settler colonialism, which in its structure is genocidal. The settler regime cannot sustain itself without violence and cannot exist, coexist with the indigenous population. So what the Israeli regime needs is more continuous violence that will, of course, cause more resistance. So in this case, anything Palestinians actually have to do to become a threat to the Zionists is stay at home, let alone actually perform acts of resistance that destabilize the Zionist enemy.
But I mean, Danielle, for 10 days, the Zionist Israeli entity and its intelligence system was driven by hysteria generated by their failure to find the young hero Uday Tamimi, who stormed the Shafat checkpoint on October 8th. Attacked an enemy soldier and killed a female soldier before he just withdrew in peace without being touched. That was the fourth occupation soldier killed in 1 month in occupied Palestine. What has changed in Palestine, and where do you think this is headed?
Yes, so recently the Zionist regime has increased its killing of the Palestinian population. This year alone, over 170 Palestinians were killed, including an average one Palestinian a day this month in the West Bank alone. The Zionist regime has increased its checkpoints, its restrictions on the freedom of movement of Palestinians. So the reactions of Palestinians are obviously legitimate forms of resistance against this regime. And it shows again how nervous the colonizer is about the response of the indigenous population, in particular because many people have taken to the street as a response to the settler terrorism that settlers in the West Bank are attacking Palestinians, being backed by the mainstream institutions of the Zionist enemy and the complicity of, as many argue, the Palestinian Authority as a colonial instrument of the Zionist regime, and of course the lack of any international law or mechanism that would protect Palestinians from the state terrorism that they are subjected to. So of course these are legitimate reactions of resistance, but again they show that the Zionist regime has to come up time and time again with new forms of control and containment effectively continue oppressing Palestinians. And these responses have increased recently, as we've seen with people taking to the street and again putting and questioning all of these, destabilizing the power structures that the Zionist apartheid regime has been imposing.
Well, this is what I wanted to ask you about, because without any warning, without any decision, we just saw Palestinians flocking the streets in many cities across the occupied villages and the refugee camps in the occupied West Bank and in occupied Al-Quds as well, after announcing that Udaya Tamimi was martyred. The entire West Bank experienced confrontations at many levels. It began in Shafat, it continued to Al-Quds, and then we saw thousands of young men gathering in front of the house of Uday's family, trying to show support for the family, and massive rallies took also part. These Palestinians took part in protests in Jenin, in Al-Khalil, Hebron in the south, and they headed even to very risky, let's say, frontline points and military checkpoints of the Israeli occupation forces. This reminds us of the Intifada of Palestine. Are we on the verge of a third Intifada in occupied Palestine?
Yeah, I think the events that you pointed to obviously indicate that there is a stronger and broader sort of frustration, I would even say, from the occupied population, obviously going against the occupier. And again, it also shows the continuity of Palestinian resistance. And despite the fact that the Zionist occupier has employed all means at her disposal to not only oppress, but also to fragment Palestinians physically into enclaves in the West Bank to restrict communication within Palestine among Palestinians, it has not managed to prevent Palestinians from taking to the streets and from protesting in all these different forms, which again is a very a legitimate form of resistance. Palestinians have the right to take up arms and any means at their disposal to fight and to protect themselves against this terrorism. And yeah, the situation could definitely increase and lead to another form of what is oftentimes considered as an intifada, even though, of course, at the same time, many Palestinians say that the intifada and these actions of resistance are a continuity and are something that takes place continuously and is not necessarily restricted to a particular time frame. But it does indicate that the frustration is resulting again in different forms of protest against the Zionist colonizer.
Even different forms of new resistance, like the Lion's Den, for example. What are your thoughts about that in less than a minute?
Exactly. So it's obviously a current moment that has received a lot of support throughout historic Palestine from Palestinians in different regions of Palestine who went to the street to show their solidarity and support, and just shows again how effective and effectively organized the resistance is and how it is connected to its land and the idea of the liberation, and again shows the strength of it as opposed to the colonizer that is continues to be a colonial outpost. And here is, I think, again where the strength of the resistance and its goal towards liberation lies.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Daniel Yagich, academic and political commentator, for joining us to talk about this new wave of Palestinian generation that is adamant on fighting the occupation and liberating their lives and their land. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Daniel, and please stay tuned because next we will be talking about how Sana'a is preventing others from looting Yemeni oil.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Ansarullah declared it plainly. Yemeni oil and gas cannot be allowed to go to Europe or any other country while the Yemeni people are suffering from a gas and oil crisis. Hence why Yemen's armed forces announced on the 21st of October carrying out a warning drone strike on Al-Dabba port of Hadramaut in order to prevent a Greek tanker, the Nissos Kea, from looting oil from the facility. The warning message came after addressing the authorities of that ship and informing them of the decision based on Yemeni laws. The ship was then dealt with through cautionary measures, through which Ansarullah were keen to preserve the safety of its crew and the security of Yemen's infrastructure while making sure that the Yemeni oil stays inside Yemen. Sana'a prevents looting of Yemeni oil in this following report.
Sana'a carried out its first warnings to shipping companies operating in transporting Yemeni crude oil from governorates outside its control by targeting a Greek ship that approached the port of Al-Dabba and violated Ansarullah's warnings. After a former Greek ship left Yemeni territorial waters in the Arabian Sea last week due to warnings, another ship called the Nissos risked entering towards the Dabba oil port. Located in the administrative framework of the Ashehr district east of Mukalla, the capital of the Hadramaut governorate in the east of the country. According to informed Yemeni sources, the Greek ship has been parked in international waters for about a week after receiving promises of protection from the Ministry of Transport in the government in Yemen's south, aimed at loading 2 million barrels of Yemeni crude oil. According to navigation monitoring, the ship entered the Yemeni waters in the Arabian Sea at dawn on Friday and approached the Dabba port, and upon its arrival, the port was attacked at exactly 2:30 p.m. in the afternoon. According to the statement of the governor of Hadramaut, loyal to the Saudi coalition of aggression, Mabhout bin Mahdi, the operation was carried out by drones, the first targeting the area separating the port and the submersible in which the ship was anchored, and minutes later another attack was carried out on the pavement of the port. According to bin Mahdi, Sana'a had issued warnings to the Greek Ministry of Transport not to approach the Yemeni territorial waters, which was conveyed to the ship's crew. After the strike, the ship withdrew out of the Yemeni territorial waters. As a result, Petromasila stopped pumping oil from the Masila oil facility to the port, and all its workers were evacuated from the port. All official roads leading to the Adaba oil port in the Asher district were also closed down by the security authorities, and a security and military emergency was declared in the Dabba Axis, which follows orders from the coalition of aggression. Spokesman for the Yemeni Armed Forces, Brigadier General Yahya Saria, confirmed later in a brief military statement that Sana'a carried out the attack and said, "We carried out a simple warning strike to prevent an oil ship that was trying to loot crude oil through the port of Al-Dabba in Hadramaut Governorate." Saria confirmed that the oil ship violated the decision issued by the Yemeni authorities to ban the transportation and export of Yemeni sovereign oil derivatives, and indicated that the warning message came to prevent the continuation of the looting of oil wealth and not to privatize it to serve the people in salaries and services. Saria explained that the ship was dealt with in accordance with Yemeni laws and international law, with cautionary measures through which Ansarullah were keen to preserve the safety and security of Yemen's infrastructure and the security of the ship and its crew. Ansarullah's warning operation was directed to all ships operating in the field of transporting Yemeni crude oil, which Sana'a accuses of the government loyal to the coalition of looting about 20 million barrels since 2016, and calls for linking crude oil sales to the payment of the salaries of civil and military state employees without exception.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Ali Murad, researcher, columnist, and political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Ali. Now, the Yemeni Armed Forces spokesperson, Brigadier General Yahya Saria, said that the Yemeni Armed Forces carried out what he called a simple warning strike in order to prevent an oil ship that was carrying or trying to carry crude oil through the port of Al-Dabba and Hadramaut Governorate. Oil that is meant by Sana'a to pay the salaries of employees, whether civil or military ones, for their salaries to be paid, which is basically the main issue right now inside of Yemen. Do you think that Ansarullah will be able, by doing so, to control the crude oil that is being looted out of Yemen?
There is no doubt that this step taken by Sana'a, as per what Brigadier General Yahya Saria announced, was an anticipated step given the media speeches that were propagated by Sana'a throughout the recent weeks. This media speech was one of a warning tone against the coalition of aggression countries and Western countries, on top of which is the United States of America, who were looting the Yemeni oil at such a cheap price. Sana'a was clear that this looting process has to stop and will be made to stop. This was evident by the warnings issued by Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, who said that in light of the unjustified blockade that Sana'a and all governorates under the capital's authority, it is no longer acceptable nor allowed for the Yemeni oil and gas to be looted the way things have been going since before 2015. When Sana'a issued those threats, it leaned on its actual operational and political capacity to execute those threats. Past experiences indicate that every time Sana'a issues a threat or announces a new equation of military engagement, it always executes what it had promised to do. Sana'a has already proven its seriousness when it comes to its project towards liberation from regional and international hegemony. Restoring rights and deterring the coalition of aggression that has been colluding against the Yemeni people since before 2015. Ansarullah fully enjoy the operational abilities, and it is absolutely true what Brigadier Saria said. He said that this attack on Hadramaut was just a message, and truly was so. Sana'a made sure that none of the Dabba port workers were injured as a result of the drone attacks. You see, if Sana'a wanted to inflict injuries against any civilian workers, it would have done so in its previous attacks. A proof of that is when Sana'a sent drone attacks to the Saudi Aramco oil facility in Abqiq in September 2019, where the targets were extremely accurate and no civilian was killed at the time, despite the fact that the attack back then was a huge one. This means that Ansarullah possesses the professional and practical ability to execute exactly what they promise against the coalition of aggression or the mercenaries that are loyal to the aggression south of Yemen.
But today we see that Yemen is imposing, or the Yemeni capital here, Sana'a, is imposing a new equation, which is oil for government salaries. But although this attack is local, meaning it happened inside Yemeni land, isn't this also considered an escalation against the coalition of aggression countries, which basically allows these international crude oil ships to enter Yemeni territorial waters in Hadramaut, for example, while they suffocate Hudaydah port and they do not even allow humanitarian aid to enter through Hudaydah port?
Well, formally, who is supposedly controlling and managing the Yemen oil facilities is the so-called legitimacy government of Yemen, or the Presidential Council south of Yemen. But practically, the side who controls the foreign oil contracts and the side who receive the foreign oil ships who docks in Hadramaut to loot and export Yemen's oil is basically the UAE and Saudi Arabia. The UAE in particular, especially in the oil of Shabwa and Hadramaut. This means that this new deterrence equation that was initiated by Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, and this is being executed by the Yemeni armed forces, is an equation that is, yes, addressed for the coalition of aggression. Sana'a calculated in precision the step that it took in Hadramaut, and the timing of this attack was very well planned, in light of a similar experience that took place on the eastern part of the Mediterranean, with the equation that was initiated by Hezbollah to deter the Zionist entity and to restore Lebanon's maritime rights from the hands of the Americans and the Zionists. Hezbollah, along with the official Lebanese government, were successful in that file. Hence, Sana'a knows very well that there is a current international condition that suits Yemen to reclaim its rights in oil and gas derivatives. The West in general, and the US and Europe in specific, are in dire need of any oil shipment that comes from any part of the world. Which is why the timing of announcing this new deterrent equation was very clever, because Ansarullah will now impose their rightful demands on the coalition of aggression and the West too, meaning the US and Europe specifically, because there are European oil companies operating inside Yemen, looting Yemeni oil, like, for example, the French Total Company. Hence, there is somewhat of an intersection between what happened in the Lebanese maritime demarcation file to secure its oil and gas rights, and now the Yemeni right in their own oil and gas fields. The same companies and the same international parties are present in both Lebanon and Yemen, which Yemen is trying today to deter and to restore their rights from.
But doesn't this actually put out a preliminary escalation to another possible wave of attacks against Saudi oil facilities inside Saudi Arabia? And if so, if Yemen will go out on another wave of attacks, how will Saudi Arabia handle these attacks in light of the global demand for crude oil production?
Well, the world is witnessing a new conflict between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the United States of America concerning the price of oil and the percentage of crude oil production as per the decision taken by OPEC plus countries. Meanwhile, in Yemen, after the passing of October 2, which was the date that was supposed to witness the renewal of the ceasefire treaty between Yemen and the coalition of aggression, however, no truce renewal was announced, hence all options are on the table. Last week, the deterrence equation was restricted to the Yemeni land against foreign companies looting Yemeni oil. However, I believe in the event of the tenacity of the coalition of aggression to achieve the demands of the Yemenis, then maybe the deterrence equation will expand to include oil facilities in both Saudi Arabia and the UAE. This is a very critical matter for the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in the event Yemeni missiles and drones return to targeting Saudi oil facilities. This will constitute a big problem for Mohammed bin Salman, especially when the US is looking to reassess its relationship with the Saudis as a result of the OPEC plus decisions, which in turn will lead to an increase in the price of oil production. This is something that the West does not want to see happen, and this will eventually further complicate the problematic situation between Mohammed bin Salman and the West. At this moment, Yemen has a golden opportunity to restore its rights through openly threatening Saudi oil facilities in the event Yemenis do not benefit from the oil that is being stolen out of their own land.
So definitely it's an opportunity the same way it was for Lebanon with the Zionist entity. It is an opportunity right now for Yemen when it comes to Saudi Arabia. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ali Murad, researcher and political commentator, for joining us to talk about what's going on in Yemen, which, by the way, ladies and gents, happens to be not followed by the Western mainstream media, which is why you see it right here, because we give you what the West never does. Thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Amid the news of high energy costs in Europe and households' inability to cope with the crisis, European companies are also slashing manufacturing due to inflation from rising energy costs. In this regard, we have taken a look at some of the world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote, European private sector activity in the Eurozone took another hit in October as the Purchasing Managers Index compiled by S&P Global slumped to its lowest level since April 2013, excluding pandemic lockdowns, Bloomberg reported recently. The index fell to 47.1 this month, down from 48.1 in September, which was worse than economists had predicted. A reading below 50 indicates a contraction. With business activity slowing, fears of a looming recession are mounting across the euro area. The steepest activity losses have been reported in manufacturing, especially in energy-intensive sectors like chemicals and plastics, but services output also dropped for a third consecutive month as consumers struggle with the cost of living crisis, according to data. Demand for goods and services shrank as companies and households are facing pressure due to inflation, which is largely stemming from skyrocketing energy costs. The Eurozone economy looks set to contract in the fourth quarter given the steepening loss of output and deteriorating demand picture seen in October, adding to speculation that a recession is looking increasingly inevitable, an economist at S&P Global, Chris Williamson, said in a statement. While some firms have even reported improved shipping in October, economists point out that suppliers were less busy due to falling demand. According to the outlet, input buying by manufacturers fell at one of the steepest rates since the global financial crisis. Price pressures, meanwhile, remain stubbornly elevated as rising energy and staff costs and the weakened euro offset any lowering of commodity prices linked to improving supply conditions. Williamson said, adding that the situation economically is getting worse quite rapidly. The S&P Global report suggests that the economies of the 19 countries that use the euro currency will drop by 0.2% in the first quarter and points out that the downturn may accelerate. Given that some economies are already pricing in an economic slowdown by the end of the year, a number of firms across the euro area have suspended hiring, while others are cutting down on staff. The website of CNBC wrote, European business activity took another hit in the month of October, reporting the steepest output loss since April 2013, excluding pandemic lockdowns. Firms have been under pressure due to higher inflation, particularly coming from energy costs and wage pressures. The Eurozone's Flash Composite Purchasing Managers Index fell to 47.1 in October, down from 48.1 in September. A reading below 50 represents a contraction in activity. The European Central Bank said in September that the 19-member bloc is set to grow 3.1% this year and 0.9% in 2030. The Central Bank also forecast inflation at 8.1% this year at 2.3% in 2024. Manufacturing activity led the losses, but services output also dropped for a third consecutive month. In terms of national breakdown, business activity in Germany came in at 44.1 versus 45.7 in the previous month. Over in France, activity stagnated with a reading at 50 from 51.2 in September. Williamson said, "The situation economically is getting worse quite rapidly." According to CNBC, Melanie Di Bono, senior Europe economist at Pantheon Macroeconomy, said the latest data points to a German recession as the energy shock is increasingly hitting the real economy. The euro lost ground against the US dollar and the British pound during morning deals in London, trading at 982 tenths dollars and 868 tenths pounds respectively, and following the latest PMA data. The euro has been under pressure amid a hawkish Federal Reserve and the energy crisis facing the eurozone in the wake of Russia-Ukraine crisis. The EBC is expected to raise rates by another 75 basis points when it meets recently. This would be the third consecutive increase to the main rate in the eurozone after a 50 basis point hike in July and a 75 basis point jump in September. The main rate is currently sitting at 0.75%, but EBC watchers expect that further rate hikes in the coming months could push it to about 2% by the end of the year. Sebastian Galli, senior macro strategist at Nordea Asset Management, said the question now is whether the EBC can avoid a severe recession amid an inflation shock. Aggressive policy tightening could push the euro area into a recession, particularly as consumer prices hit record levels. Euro area annual inflation was 9.9% in September, according to the region's statistics office, and the highest ever on record. Several economies are already pricing in an economic slowdown before the end of the year. However, ECB member Gabriel McAuliffe said last week that despite the risk of a recession, further rate increases remain necessary, according to Reuters.
A senior Iranian lawmaker
has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
The International Monetary Fund's latest World Economic Outlook forecasts that Iran's economy will experience positive growth in 2022 for the third year in a row, in spite of tough sanctions imposed by the United States against Iran and the impact of the global coronavirus pandemic. The IMF also anticipated that Iran's inflation rate and balance of its current accounts will improve in the current year. The international body had put Iran's inflation rate in 2021 at 40.1%, adding that not only Iran's inflation rate will not increase in the current year as compared to a year earlier, but also it will hit 40% in general, showing a bit of improvement. Nonetheless, the state of Iran's economy is one of the main forces propelling Iranians into the streets these days, socio-political experts say. A sense of disillusionment over the failure of conservative administrations to improve the economy has been a factor in unifying the government's opponents and supporters inside the country. Ordinary citizens denounce the recent riots, street vandalism, and the illegal U.S. sanctions, but say that the majority of Iranians, regardless of their political views, are concerned about their livelihoods today and for their children's future. For an analysis of the state of the Islamic Republic's economy in resisting U.S. sanctions, stay with us on this edition of Iran Today. Decades of inhumane U.S.-led sanctions aimed at Iranian people and government, along with the impact of a pandemic compounded by internal mismanagement and corruption, have hindered Iran's economy in terms of growth and progress. Some 655 Iranian entities and individuals were sanctioned under the administration of former U.S. President Barack Obama, according to the Center for New American Security. But the most brutal punishment kicked off in 2018 after Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew the U.S. from the Iran nuclear deal with world powers, and as a result, Iran's banks were cut off from the worldwide interbank financial telecommunication system.
Life under sanctions makes the country that is under it try to find alternative ways and use creativity. This happened, and the U.S. had the idea during the Obama era that the Secretary of State, Mrs. Clinton, said that we imposed paralyzing sanctions on Iran. Apparently, she was the one paralyzed, and the sanctions could not paralyze Iran. It has made it hard, it has made it difficult, but it never reached the level of paralyzing, and the growth of our economy and the growth of our production is the testimony. Of course, let me tell you that our last decade consisted of very little growth, growth of 0.4%. But during the last year, we saw a growth of 3.7%, and in the months that have passed so far this year, we saw a growth of 4.7%. This shows that Mr. Raisi's government was able to take important steps in the country's economic growth. Recently, the International Monetary Fund announced Iran's rank in the world economy at 21st place, and while it had been announced previously, we were downgraded to 28th place at one point. So this shows that Iran's economy has improved.
No sector of Iran's economy was spared by Washington's punitive measures, which forced the country into a two-year recession and continue to impact every aspect of day-to-day life of the Iranian people. Today, all of those sanctions are still enforced by the current administration of U.S. President Joe Biden.
Ultimately, the Trump administration targeted Iran's economy with more than 960 sanctions that continued endlessly as Iran's healthcare system was severely impacted under the most brutal waves of COVID-19 infections seen in West Asia. And despite appeals by world leaders to offer Tehran a temporary respite for humanitarian reasons. In the face of new sanctions, Iran's leaders remained defiant, introducing the doctrine of resistance economy that would make the country more self-sufficient and less reliant on imports and oil sales. The government invested in domestic industries, urging Iranians to buy local. It also continued to get around the sanctions by selling its oil to international buyers at a discounted rate.
In terms of international trade, in addition to the growth of non-oil exports, we also had growth in oil exports, which had several very specific reasons. We used policies that let us actually sell more oil and turn it into petroleum products, the same policy that was used in neutralizing sanctions. And with this act, we turned oil into products that cannot be embargoed. With this policy of having an overseas refinery, our main discussion was that we cannot sell oil now, so instead we should try to export technical engineering services related to refinery equipment. Since 2018, when we were subjected to heavy sanctions, the United States wanted to cripple us through the gasoline embargo. But our actions and their continuation in the last decade caused us to become self-sufficient in many refinery equipments, and we actually reached a place where we export technical engineering services today to countries like Venezuela, Uzbekistan, or Syria. This means that these countries have inactive or semi-active refineries, which we will first use our services to bring them to full capacity. And through this process, our oil is also sold.
Despite the unprecedented pressure imposed on a country in modern history, Iran is still considered as one of the world's largest economies. The International Monetary Fund, the IMF, in its latest report indicated Iran has the 21st largest economy in the world, announcing that in effect 171 countries in the world have a smaller economy than Iran in 2022.
One of Mr. Raisi's achievements is the relative stability of the exchange rate. When his government started working, the dollar price in the open market was 28,000 tomans. During the past year, this has reached 32 to 33,000. It means that the price has increased by 15 to 17%. This is while our inflation has been 40%. That means if we would have grown in line with inflation, the current rate would be much higher than this. This is a sign of relative stability because we cannot freeze the exchange rate by force. This point is very important. The exchange rate should be adjusted according to the needs of export and import with inflationary conditions. Of course, as long as inflation is controlled, we'll see more stability in the exchange rate.
Measures taken, consistent with the resistance economy doctrine, helped the country grow 4.7% in 2021, according to recent World Bank data. Furthermore, as stated in the latest IMF report, it is expected that Iran's GDP will reach $1,599 billion in the current year, based on the Purchasing Power Index, the rate of which will increase by $150 billion as compared to last year. Additionally, the IMF statistics indicated that Iran's economy is now twice as large as some of the Western European economies, such as Switzerland, Sweden, Austria, and Ireland.
In my opinion, what's happening in Iran's economy is this. When you say that the amount of tax revenues has increased by more than 60% compared to last year, when you say that our oil sales have increased 8 times, and when you say that our non-oil exports are going through a growing trend. This means that the source of government funding for current annual budget has changed.
Having proven more resilient and diversified than some predicted, Iran's economy started to return to growth last year, thanks to an easing of cross-border trade, COVID-19 restriction rollbacks, and a sharp rebound in oil prices. Iranian Statistics Agency figures published last month showed that the country's economy had expanded by 3.8% in the first quarter of the calendar year that started late March.
Another good event has taken place domestically at the Minister of Economy and the Iranian Tax Administration. You see, in the first 5 months of the last year, our total tax revenues were about 130 billion tomans. This figure reached 230,000 billion in the first 5 months of this year. It means that there has been a growth of more than 60%. This is while the taxes from production sector has also decreased by 5%. But it doesn't mean that there is an additional pressure on the production. These are general and positive measures that are happening in two Iranian ministries and their subsidiaries. A new approach in the field of foreign trade centered at the Trade Development Organization, and a new approach in the field of provincial taxes in the tax system. These changes show that there is a new trend in Iran.
Moving in the right direction last year, the personal income of Iranians rose more than 3 times faster than GDP per capita. According to the Statistical Center of Iran, incomes rose last year at rates significantly higher than inflation. Inflation for the year was 42%, but incomes and expenditures outpaced inflation by a significant margin, rising by about 53%. Furthermore, indicators such as the Human Development Index are high in Iran, and social services are acceptable compared to many countries of the same level. According to the United Nations Development Program, the Human Development Index in Iran is better than countries such as China, India, Brazil, South Africa, and Egypt.
These events are natural and happen in every country, but I feel that the reason why this issue continued, which is also related to the fact that the hand of foreign countries can be seen in the continuation of these riots and unrest. But even though people's livelihood may have improved in the last year, it has not been a tangible improvement that people can actually understand and feel, and say a significant difference compared to the past can be seen in our lives. Certainly in terms of livelihood, it has not been seen. All right, that's accepted. But there have been positive events that I will share with you. In focusing too much on the JCPOA, the Iranian government put all its eggs in the JCPOA basket, causing it to neglect other capacities that exist. And when the United States withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018, it brought a big shock to Iran's economy.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Human Development Indicators, published annually by the United Nations Development Program, provide broad measures of well-being worldwide. There are three data dimensions: life expectancy, education, and purchasing power parity. The UNDP has recently issued its newest HDI report, which contains statistics related to 191 countries, including Iran. The 2022 report shows that the ranking of the Islamic Republic of Iran has improved to 76 in 2021. The COVID-19 pandemic affected the HDI globally in 2020.